1234. Read the latest news at KAXE.org or sign up for podcasts or newsletters. It's 6 o'clock.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
Regime unchanged. A journalist tells us her contacts in Iran say the state repression apparatus remains in full working order and that it will take a lot more than the death of the supreme leader for the regime to crumble, which leaves the citizens of Iran in a very dangerous position.
And gross interference. A New Yorker tells us she was tired of seeing the used tissues and underwear and other unpleasant items that people wedge into the fence along the Brooklyn Bridge. So she decided to take matters into her own hands, which we hope were wearing gloves.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Monday edition of As It Happens.
It's a minute after 6 o'clock. News from As It Happens is coming up next. I'm Heidi Holton. Hope you're having a good evening. We receive support from Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984. Performing auto body and collision repair and auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at dalesautobodyinc.com. We're going to listen to some music from a Minnesota artist now. This is Lamar.
People go online up more than you've ever seen. My mind, should I hold my tongue? Should I stand my ground? Can I turn and run? And I try to keep my patience, losing all my grace, and all I wanna do is find some shade. And I'm running out of options. Someone call the cops, and everywhere I go, I'm out of place. Line around the block, staring at my watch. People trying to talk, I just wanna walk. When's it gonna stop, stop? Shuffling her feet, standing in the heat. Rising from the street, hiding in my grief. Trying to keep it sweet, like give me lemonade. Put me in the shade, tell me it's okay. It was a mistake, it was just a bad dream. Dreaming of a car, dreaming I'm a star.
Trying to keep it sweet, like give me lemonade, put me in the shade, tell me it's okay, it was a mistake, it was just
That is Minnesota artist Lamar. Tune in at 9 o'clock tomorrow for Headwaters with Malachi Coons. Everyone is invited to Singing for Our Neighbors, a community sing-along for unity and healing. It's this Saturday at 2 p.m. at Community Presbyterian Church in Grand Rapids. Hosted by community volunteers, donations in support of mutual aid will be accepted. Also this Saturday, Bemidji Symphony Orchestra invites you to their Symphony Showcase, 7 to 9 at the Loft Event Center, downtown Bemidji. There'll be solos, duets, small ensembles with light snacks. Find tickets at Bemidji Symphony.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
issuing orders in chaos after 3 days of U.S. and Israeli airstrikes across Iran, a journalist tells us that despite the death of the Ayatollah, the regime remains in full crackdown mode.
A recipe for succession. A pro-regime academic in Tehran tells us the government has a clear plan to stay in power and says Iranians are united against their true enemies, the U.S. and Israel.
Support in a storm. One of Canada's last diplomats in Iran tells us Prime Minister Carney did the right thing by supporting strikes on the country, regardless of the potential fallout at home.
She liked them. Now she despises them. Our guest built a seasonings company called Spice Girls with a Y and a Z. But now that the 90s girl power pop group is threatening to sue her, she's feeling kind of salty.
Taking time for the litter things, with the world feeling like a dumpster fire, one New Yorker decided to focus on a problem she could do something about, cleaning up the Brooklyn Bridge.
And fear of heights. Major League Baseball has a new system that can tell for sure whether a pitch was high, low, or just right. But for it to work, a lot of players are having to admit they're not as tall as they claim to be. As It Happens, the Monday edition, radio that never shrinks from the truth. Donald Trump says attacks on Iran will continue for as long as it takes. The U.S. president says the American and Israeli strikes are aimed at destroying Iran's ability to fire ballistic missiles, destroying their navy, and ensuring that a nuclear weapon is out of reach. But civilians have also been killed, including at an elementary school, where Iranian authorities say dozens of children are among the dead. After the first attacks, the Trump administration urged Iranians to take over the government. But today, regime change was noticeably absent from the U.S. president's remarks. Nilou Tabrizi is a journalist and author. We reached her in New York.
Nilou, it's certainly not easy to get a hold of people inside Iran, especially now. What have you been hearing from your contacts there?
Yes, actually, I was able to connect with a source from Isfahan today who let me know that, you know, Isfahan is a little bit calmer compared to Tehran, mm-hmm. that is under heavy airstrikes today. Something that they told me that's really important to mention is that, repression by state forces is already starting. This source told me that at different intersections in town, there are armed guards that are standing there. And the source even sent me screenshots of a text message, of several text messages that they got from a state-aligned phone number that was warning people to stay inside and to not go out and protest. So, I mean, even in this moment, the state's repression, you know, apparatus continues.
Mm-hmm. So as significant and seismic, certainly, as the killing of the Ayatollah is, it hasn't changed anything materially for those who wanted a change.
Right. No. I mean, when Khamenei was killed over the weekend, I saw videos of people celebrating in the streets. And of course, you can understand that joy, right? This is a population that has just survived a horrible massacre. And so, of course, people are going to cheer, for the death of this leader whose legacy is one of just vicious state cruelty. But of course, the power vacuum is the next thing that many people are concerned about. And it's not as if the death of one leader is going to crumble the Islamic Republic. It's not as if we're seeing any breaks in the ranks from, you know, Revolutionary Guards or other policing units, that the repression remains.
Do you have friends and family back in Iran? And have you been able to reach them if you do?
I do. So I was born in Iran and I immigrated to Canada, to Vancouver, when I was in preschool. So I grew up in Canada, but I have a ton of friends and family in Iran. I haven't been able to contact anybody personally. You know, Iranians are very tech savvy people. But no, I mean, even the VPNs aren't working. And we saw that as well with the nationwide uprisings in December and January. The internet was cut. And that always creates so much anxiety, right? Because it just feels as if every time the Islamic Republic cuts off the internet, the worst horrors, you know, are committed in that blackout.
I know, Nilou, you've also been trying to verify footage of the elementary school that was hit. There were reports, you know, conflicting reports about who might have hit the school, whether it was U.S. Or Israeli airstrikes or something else. But as you look at that footage, what can you tell us about what you've seen?
So the first thing was just being able to verify the video itself. So making sure it was actually of the day that it was reported. So I was able to do that quickly. And the next thing I wanted to do was to figure out exactly where the school was located, you know, as granular as knowing the exact coordinates so that I could look at it on satellite imagery and mapping to understand where the school is situated, what was around it, because it's just simply horrifying to hear the news of a primary school, you know, an elementary school being hit. And what I did notice was that the school in Minab in Hormozgan province, which is in the south of the country, it's very close to an IRGC Navy barracks. And so a source told me, someone that has worked in a defense capacity, and said, you know, maybe this was just, to me, it looks like human error because it's so close to the base. But when I look at this image, when I look at the school on Google Earth, for the past, you know, at least 8 years, the colors of the wall are pastel, you know, they're brightly colored, which looks so different from a type of, you know, IRGC base that obviously wouldn't be colored in that way. So it's really unfortunate to, you know, think, okay, is this just due to human error? Because if myself, like if I'm an investigative journalist, if I can understand that this is a school, you know, so too should the folks who are responsible for adding this to targeting lists. And that's what's so heartbreaking.
What have you seen in some of the footage that you're able to share?
Yeah, it's really, really, really grim. So I've seen things like bloodstained backpacks, schoolwork that's tattered. I saw a hand of a small child who's a really tiny hand in the rubble. Particularly the audio is awful, right? You see the video from the scene is just dotted by shrieks and screams of people that are taking in the scene. It's just, it's horrible.
How are you handling all of this, Nilou? Not just what you've been trying to investigate and verify. What is this moment like for you?
Gosh, it's awful. I mean, this is kind of the moment that so many of us have feared, of seeing Iran in direct conflict with the U.S., with the U.S. and its partners. And so kind of this horrific nightmare has come to life, because as we saw with the Minab school, for example, the most vulnerable are always the casualties of war. I mean, that is just very clear. And so, yeah, I mean, just watching my worst dreams realized feels awful. But there's so few of us who do this work, partly because when you start reporting on Iran, as you know, as someone who was born there, you can never return. And so doing this work means that I can't ever visit Iran with this system in place. And so, yeah, there's a lot of grief in many aspects, grief of watching, you know, what's happening to Iran, of being stressed out, not being able to connect with friends and loved ones. And then of knowing that each time I do a type of investigative report and do any type of journalism about Iran, it's just a confirmation that, you know, it's not a place I'll ever be able to return to while this is in place.
The U.S. president speaking today, and the defense secretary as well, you know, are talking about potential timelines and what the goals are here, but very clearly stepping away from this idea of regime change. What does that shift, or what they're saying today, suggest to you about what will happen next in the country?
I really don't know. I think the comments are confusing for Iranians in the country to hear, because on one hand, you know, as protests were going on in the last month, the U.S. president said help is on the way, and people continue to pour out in the streets and put their bodies on the line. And now Iranians are hearing the president say, take to the streets, this is your opportunity, and now moving away from that. And it also confirms, you know, what many intelligence cables and reporting have shown us, which is, you know, regime change and is very difficult. And so ultimately, the people of Iran are going to pay the price.
Nilou, I appreciate this. Thank you. And please take care.
Thank you very much.
Nilou Tabrizi is a journalist and author. We reached her in New York. Fouad Izadeh is a professor at the University of Tehran and a supporter of the Iranian government. We reached him in Tehran.
Professor, what has it been like for you in Tehran today?
Very difficult. We have had many attacks throughout the day. Different places in Tehran were bombed. We are at home. Sometimes I go out. I'm out right now. There is no particular way, and attacks are indiscriminate. The idea is to inflict a lot of pain to the civilians, what they did in Gaza, attack infrastructure, so they get to some political objective that they have.
You ventured out, which is remarkable. What was it like when you went out? Are other people staying inside? What are your neighbors saying?
Most people are staying inside. The government asked people to leave large cities because they're thinking that the smaller towns would be safer. So they're encouraging people to leave if they can. Some people cannot leave, but for those who can, the government is encouraging people to leave cities like Tehran.
Who is leading your country right now?
You know, Iran's constitution is clear on this issue. If the leader, for whatever reason, cannot perform his duties, there is a committee of three: the president, the head of judiciary, and a member of the Guardian Council. And these people started working on the day that the leader was assassinated. So that committee is functioning, and Iran's constitution elects leaders through the assembly of experts. That's the name, 88 people who are elected directly by the general public, and they will be electing the leader, I think, in the next few days.
So there was a plan. There's the constitution, as you say, these three people leading for now. The death of the Ayatollah, yeah, though, is no small thing. It is seismic, as I've said to other guests,
yes,
and there's no denying that. Were you surprised to hear that he had been killed?
So we are dealing with very vicious people. Iran is fighting for Iran. Iran is fighting for the civilized world. If Trump gets away with what he's doing to Iran, Canada would be next. Iran is fighting for Canada. So this is very difficult. We are dealing with two nuclear regimes. It's not easy. Iran's military is powerful, but these militaries, the United States spends, the military expenditure is 100 times more than what Iran spends on its military.
There are many Iranians who will take exception to a lot of what you're saying. The brutality of the regime is well documented. In terms of the recent protests, some estimates say more than 6,000 people were killed. Others count many, many more dead, into the tens of thousands. What would you say, Professor, to those who feel this moment might be a turning point, a new beginning for their country?
We have something called investigative journalism, fact-checking. You used to do it. Your organization used to do it. I'm surprised you're not doing it anymore, because Iranian government published the names of all the people who were killed. 3,000 is the number, 3,007. And Trump or Netanyahu or your organization have not been able to add one more name. Iranian government published all the names with the ID numbers. These are fake news.
Citing Donald Trump's speech or his numbers, but as you know, there are many people who have left Iran because of the repression there. But I wonder, since you referenced Donald Trump, he, in his latest speech, talked about the objectives for this war: destroying Iran's missile capabilities, quote, annihilating its navy, preventing Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons, and ensuring that the regime cannot continue to fund regional proxies. They seem to be stepping away, though, from this idea of regime change. What do you make of the U.S. administration's most recent comments? What does that suggest to you about how long this could drag on?
It depends on him. He has started the war. As long as he continues to attack Iran, Iran doesn't have any other choice but to defend. This is Article 51 of the UN Charter. When your country is attacked, you're supposed to defend yourself. That's international law. And they want to change Iran's government. On the first day of attacks, this is what he said. This is what Netanyahu said. This is what they wanted to do in January. This is not the war that Iran has started. They started it. They started attacking Iran illegally. There was no UN resolution. This is against international law. You're not supposed to go and kill the leaders of other countries. This is, they're creating mayhem. And if they can get away with it with Iran, Canada would be next. The situation that we have is very difficult. Iran has no other choice but to resist. There was a diplomatic solution available. I don't know if you saw the interview of the Omani foreign minister. He went to Washington. He talked to CBS News. I hope that you watched that. He was saying that an agreement is available. He said that Iran was giving concessions that Iran did not do before, new things. And Trump attacked Iran less than 24 hours after that interview because they were afraid that this idea of having an agreement with Iran was available. And they want to change Iran's government. It's very reasonable. If you want to change a government, you don't enter a diplomatic agreement with the government that you want to change. And they're going to fail. And this is good for Iran. This is good for Canada.
What would you say to people who did not want this kind of U.S. intervention, but also did not want this current regime to continue? They want political change in their country.
They can come. If they're Iranians, they can come to Iran, run for elections, and I may be voting for them. You know, sometimes we have difficulties with the current government. Iranians understand who Trump is. They understand who Netanyahu is. They don't want to be foot soldiers for war criminals. Why would anyone, would Canadians want to be foot soldiers for Trump? Of course not. You know, Iranians are like Canadians, you know. These are very basic things. I hope that you understand what I'm telling you.
Professor, thank you for your time. Please take care.
Take care. Bye.
Fouad Izadi is a professor at the University of Tehran. That's where we reached him. It's officially March, and when I look back at February, which was uncomfortably full of days on which I had to say February, it's like a hazy, freezing dream. I watched TV, I stared out the window, ordered in, and went outside only to take the garbage out. But for Ellen Baum, February was productive, to say the least. She faced the blistering cold to take the garbage off, specifically off New York City's famous Brooklyn Bridge. It took her days, and her work is not yet done. We reached Ellen Baum in New York City.
Ellen, the last time you were at the bridge, just yesterday, if I'm not mistaken, how was it looking?
Yes, it is pretty clear. I would say maybe 99.8% of the trash is gone, although I know it will grow back over time. However, there are still locks there. So there is somebody who is helping out with that as well, a bit of a vigilante lock cutter. And I'm definitely going to be joining him in that endeavor quite soon.
It's such a beautiful walk. The last time I did it many years ago, I did not notice that this was happening. We're not talking about random trash scattered on the ground. You mentioned the locks. People, you know, they see this kind of thing in cities all over the world. But
that's right.
There are other things that caught your eye and upset you. What did it look like before yesterday, your initiative?
The peak worst of it was around the first week of February when I really saw it and was just like, this is enough. And just like an oversaturation of the stuff on the fencing that's there. I've seen everything from hair ties is the majority of what I see there, napkins, paper towels, to then receipts of things, plastic bags like from bodegas and delis, but truly disgusting things as well. I have seen condoms. I have seen tampons tied to it. I've seen women's underwear. The craziest thing, though, that I saw was a pill bottle written in Hungarian. I'm pretty sure it was collagen, but still, I was like, I can't believe that somebody would affix this to the bridge. It just feels better suited to be in the garbage.
Love locks are one thing. What's your sense? Why are people attaching these things to the bridge?
You know, I would guess that they, because there was like a mass of it already, people kind of think, oh, maybe this is a thing. I don't have anything on me. Let me see what's in my bag. It's opportunist. It's, I see this thing, I want to be a part of it, and I'm going to put whatever I have on my person up on that fencing.
And when did you decide you needed to clean this up?
I remember that morning I, you know, was going through my newsfeed and just reading some horrible things around the world and feeling a little bit helpless. And, you know, I noticed it, really just taking it in. You know, I had no headphones in, no music on. I'm just walking in and taking the surroundings. And I was so frustrated by it. It just stuck with me that day. And then I thought, you know, in these very small ways, even though I feel helpless in the world at large, there's little things that you can do in your friend group, within yourself, within your family, and in this case, within my community, that I was like, I'm just going to do it.
You could have just called the city, right? Shouldn't the city be doing this?
You know,
that might have made some people feel good. Like, you know, that would have been a self a way to do it.
Yes, I did. So the DOT is ultimately responsible for it, the New York City Transportation Department. And to be honest, I don't even blame them. We've had a tough winter of ice and cold and snow. They're not supportive of the mess that's there. It is actually against a city administrative code, although I don't think that anyone has ever received a fine for that. I don't know this for sure, but I would suspect that they just don't have the resources to do this as often as they would like. It's not the most pressing issue in the city. I know and appreciate that.
What have your cleanup days looked like?
So generally, I could be out there anywhere from an hour and a half to 2 hours, depending on how cold it is and how much time I've got in a given day. I will pick a section. And by that, I mean, there's sort of there's like very clear markers between sections of the fence, and I will pick sort of one framed area. I start with the top. I'm a little bit short, so I have a little stool that I take with me. I put on my gloves. I take out a wine key, of all things. There's like a little blade, you know, that pops out of a wine opener that you have, and I use that to kind of cut things or nick things open, and I sort of methodically take it out and put it into a trash bag, and then I dispose of it from there. I would say that every time I've been on the bridge, a handful of people will stop and talk to me. I'd say most of them are tourists and they're just curious. They're like, oh, do you work for the city? And I'm like, nope, just a citizen, just a concerned Brooklynite.
What about, have there been people who see what you're doing and are like, great, I'm still going to put this thing, put whatever I was going to put on the bridge?
Yeah. There, I mean, as I'm cleaning it, someone will come up right behind me and put something on. It's happened on camera, actually.
You mentioned the locks as well. Love locks are a tradition in a lot of places, as you know. Mm-hmm. Some people say that that's fine. You know, the other things you mentioned might need to go for sure. But love locks, you know, it's romantic for some, a memento of lovebirds there. Why do you want them gone?
Yeah, so it's really, and I mean, if you could see into my apartment, I am a sentimental person. I've got tchotchkes of every size, color, variety in my place. I do hold on to things dearly like that. But in this case, it poses a structural issue to the bridge. I know people think like, oh, you know, cars and thousands of people go on the bridge. How could it possibly cause a problem? But there are instances where, and it's happened in the past, on the Brooklyn Bridge, where a wire snapped under the weight of the love locks that were there. And it fell onto the roadway on the Brooklyn-bound traffic side. And thank goodness nobody was hurt in that. But we also have cyclists on our bridge on that roadway level. And if that happened, you know, and it collapsed onto a cyclist, I think we would be reading a much worse news story. And so, I don't think that people intend that. I think they're just not thinking of it, but it does pose risks of that. It also tends to deteriorate the paint that's under it, so it starts to rust that area. And, you know, the fences that are up now that I've been cleaning are there for safety reasons, and so we really don't want those to erode, you know, under the presence of the locks there.
So is this going to be, this is part of your weekly regular routine now, you think, or you'll move on to?
It's gonna be now. I started with the trash. Like I said, there is, and that won't stop, right? That will start to grow. Well, at the same time, I'm definitely gonna take focus to the locks next. Again, there is somebody who's doing that right now. I'm going to meet them on the bridge and sort of learn the tricks of the trade on how to do that effectively and safely and just kind of see where it goes from there.
Ellen, thank you for this.
Yeah, sure thing. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Ellen Baum cleans garbage off the Brooklyn Bridge in New York City, and that is where we reached her.
The wait is over. The automated ball strike challenge system powered by T-Mobile is coming to Major League Baseball's regular season starting on opening day in 2026 with ABS challenge.
Yes, the wait is over. The giddy anticipation. The nights of despair thinking, will the automated ball strike challenge system powered by T-Mobile ever come to Major League Baseball's regular season? That's all over. It's almost here. The automated ball strike challenge system is almost here at last. Powered by T-Mobile. When the regular MLB season starts at the end of this month, this ABS challenge system, as it's called, will allow players to challenge a ball or strike call that they feel the umpire got wrong. The system will then analyze the pitch and the call will stand or be overturned, depending. You muse, but every player is a different height, so every player's strike zone is different. That's true. I'm sorry, I couldn't help but overhear your musing. I couldn't tell if you were talking to me, though, or... Oh, you were. Okay, great. Then I'll tell you that right now, all MLB players are being measured, so the ABS challenge system will know exactly how tall every batter is, so it will be able to tell very precisely whether a given pitch was in the batter's precise strike zone. The thing is, though, it turns out that some players have been stretching more than their hamstrings. Here's a woman named Elena who runs the Instagram account Red Hot Takes.
About the new ABS challenge system is that it's required every individual athlete to get precisely measured, and a lot of guys who used to be over 6 foot have been exposed. Like my guy Gavin Lux over here, former Dodger, and not at all the reason why I started with him, used to measure at 6'2", and all of a sudden he lost 3 inches and is 5'11". And Connor Wong used to measure at 6'1", and is now 5'10". And then we have our poor guy, Zach Neto, who already got the worst break in the world, having to be the face of the Angels. Went from 6 foot to 5'11". And same thing goes for Orlando Arcia and Jurickson Profar.
Oh, dear. And they would have gotten away with it, too, if it weren't for that meddling automated ball strike challenge system powered by T-Mobile. Well, look, men exaggerate their heights. I can say that as someone who's 6'4". 5'11". And being a pro athlete is hard, but no matter how hard you try, sometimes you're going to come up short. Here's Hannah Georges with Shorty. Georges with Shorty.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, Lily Bond started her spice company nearly a decade ago when she was just 13. But after building up her Spice Girls brand, that's Spice with a Y and Girls with a Z, the Spice Girls, standard spelling, came after her, and now she has to start over.
And last night, the late Catherine O'Hara won Best Female Actor in a Comedy Series at the Actor Awards for The Studio, and Seth Rogen took the opportunity to pay emotional tribute to his genius co-star. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
It's 6:35. We've got more news coming up from As It Happens. It's the news from Canada. You catch it each weekday at this time. We receive support from the Sanford Bemidji Orthopedics and Sports Medicine Center, specializing in total joint repair. More at sanfordhealth.org. And thanks also to Hug Hydronics, committed to making in-floor heating simple, providing in-floor heating solutions for both commercial and residential. More information at hughydronics.com. Tickets are now available for United Way of Northeastern Minnesota's Flavor of the North event, April 23rd at the Range Recreation and Civic Center in Eveleth. Funds go towards the Buddy Backpack Program, which provides food to children who are at risk of going hungry while not in school. And Itasca County Habitat for Humanity offers a financial foundations course that starts March 9th. Meets monthly through July, designed to empower you to make informed financial decisions and achieve long-term goals. Register at itascahabitat.org.
Canada's government says it's supportive of U.S. actions to, quote, prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon and prevent its regime from threatening international peace and security, unquote. Prime Minister Mark Carney was quick to offer that support over the weekend, but he also made it clear that the federal government was, quote, not party to the military buildup or planning, unquote. That matches the tone of other Western allies like the U.K., Germany, and France, who released similar statements. Canada and Iran have not had a formal diplomatic relationship since 2012, when Canada kicked out Iranian diplomats and recalled the handful of Canadian diplomats who were left in Tehran. Dennis Horak was serving as Canada's head of mission in Iran at the time. We reached him today in Toronto.
Dennis Horak, what do you make of Canada's response to these strikes?
I'm not surprised. I mean, it's the support for the attacks. It's consistent with Canada's concerns that we've had with Iran, the nuclear program, the support for terrorism, support for proxy groups in the region, Iran's activities meddling in the region. It's brutal treatment of its own citizens. These are issues that Canada's long had with Iran, grievances we've had, and they are aligned very closely with the sort of rationale that the U.S. has provided, and the Israelis, for that matter, have provided for this operation. So, from a policy perspective, there is a certain alignment. Additionally, we have to consider these days, especially the importance of the bilateral relationship. It would make no sense, really, in my mind, to stand on the sidelines and criticize the United States for an operation on an issue where we have essential policy agreement. And finally, I think the government was certainly aware of the tens of thousands of Canadians who marched in the streets in February in opposition to the Iranian regime. And that would be a consideration, probably not a decisive one, but something that it would be hard for them to ignore.
Victoria Liberal MP Will Greaves went against the Prime Minister today, saying, quote, Canada cannot endorse the unilateral and illegal use of military force, the killing of civilians, or the kidnap and assassination of foreign heads of government, while also insisting that our sovereignty, our rights, and our independence must be respected, unquote. What would you say to that perspective? How can Canada say both of these things?
I understand and I do respect it, and it is troubling. I'll confess that I think it is somewhat troubling that, you know, we're in this situation where, you know, might makes right seems to be the prevailing philosophy these days, and certainly coming out of Washington, which is a little bit more troubling than we've seen in the past. And other countries have obviously had that philosophy for decades. And, you know, the U.S. has exercised this in Venezuela, and now we're seeing it here. So I understand the principle and the challenges, but on the other hand, you know, this is a regime that has been a problem for a long time.
Can you foresee a situation if this as this continues, that Canada's position would shift? What would shift Canada's position, if anything?
It could. We'll see. I mean, a lot will depend on how things go over the next days and weeks. There is a need at some point, and as the government has alluded to, for diplomacy to kick in, to figure out a way out of this. What are the next steps? We don't know what the ultimate objectives of the Americans and the Israelis are. What's the criteria they will be using to say, okay, you know, declare victory and off we go. If it's a prolonged war, if civilian casualties do continue to mount, and there doesn't seem to be an end game in place or a clear articulation of what an end game looks like, I think that will become increasingly difficult for Canada to stomach, and the call for increased and call for a stepped up diplomacy may emerge as that happens. And again, a lot will depend on what happens on the ground and how the next stages in this play out.
You've written just last June for the Globe and Mail, talking about an attempt at regime change potentially leading to chaos in Iran, that the Ayatollah would easily be replaced. We talked about that with our guests earlier. There's a council in place. Our guest was saying that there was always a succession plan and strategies in place. Doesn't mean it's not going to rattle the leadership, but it doesn't mean it's going to destroy it either. So should Canada continue to be supportive of military action that is going to cause chaos?
Yeah, it's a very good point. And chaos is entirely possible. The regime is institutionally resilient, though. And so we'll see what happens. We'll see whether the Iranians may come up with some sort of plan or some sort of proposal that would sit well with the Americans, that would indicate a change in the directions of the regime. I think, as I wrote last June, and I still believe, that somewhere within this establishment in Iran, there have to be people who are looking and saying, you know, this is ridiculous. What has all of these efforts, all of these things we've done over the last 40, 50 years, it's gotten us to this point? Is there a need to shift? To shift ground, to pivot away from this sort of revolutionary ideal and to make Iran a much more normal country? I'm not sure the people that are in power there now have that intellectually or ideologically within them to make that pivot. That's the hope, is that at some point we see, because regime change is tough, but changing the behavior of the regime should be or could be easier.
I wonder if this timing, these attacks, as negotiations were ongoing, or, you know, the U.S. said they weren't going the way they wanted, but do you think these attacks from the U.S. and Israel have made what you're describing impossible in the short term or even long term?
One of the things that with Ayatollah Khamenei, a lot of his ideology, his worldview was based on the idea that if we compromise on our key values and our key principles, we're going to lose the revolution and we're going to end up back being a vassal state of the United States. Well, that may or may not have been true. He's now no longer there. I'm sure that position is held very strongly still by many of the people who managed to replace him. Except the difference being now is they're halfway down that slippery slope already. These countries can shift. Whether they have it within them to do that now, I don't know, but we'll see.
Dennis Horak, I appreciate this. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Dennis Horak is a retired Canadian diplomat who served as Canada's head of mission in Iran from 2009 to 2012. We reached him in Toronto. Saba Khan used to volunteer at her child's school. She would help out in the library or lend a hand whenever and wherever needed. And then she got a phone call telling her she couldn't help out anymore because she wears a hijab. Ms. Khan lives in Quebec, where Bill 94, the religious symbols ban, came into effect in 2019. Things like turbans, kippahs, and hijabs aren't allowed to be worn by anyone who works or volunteers at public schools. Sabah Khan talked to Sean Henry, host of Daybreak in Montreal.
It's been very disappointing, very, very disappointing. It's taken away a lot of opportunities as well. Something so simple like volunteering on a graduation committee at like an elementary school, it isn't possible anymore if you wear hijab or a religious symbol. And it's been very upsetting and also disappointing at the same time. Another thing that's disappointing is possibly dropping off your children to a sports event. If your kids make the basketball team, you're going to want to be that parent that takes your van and takes all the kids there and brings them to the sporting event. And you're not allowed to do that under this bill. You can't do any volunteer work. So it's very disappointing. And it also sets us back. Schools need volunteers. They need all the help they can get. And there's lots of gaps in the system. And I volunteer to fill those gaps in. And it's just very disappointing that you need help, but then you're stopping people who want to help.
Have you been back to your kids' school since?
I have, actually, just to meet with staff and speak to them about how I feel. And I feel sorry for them and sad for them as well. They're being told to implement something that they don't believe in as well. And I could see the sadness and disappointment on their faces, having to tell somebody they can't come in because of a religious symbol or because of a choice they're making. It's heartbreaking. And there were actually tears. It's hard for them as well. And it also sets the school at a disadvantage, not having like a little catalog of parents to come in, whether they have a turban, a kippah, a hijab, or they choose to wear a religious symbol. It's a disadvantage because now you can't call on those people. And instead of having 20 volunteers, you might only have 5 or 10.
So that's your child's school. What about extracurricular activities? Have you attended any extracurricular activities since?
I have, but I was very worried and anxious, to be honest. I just was worried because the law lacks a lot of clarification. It's not very clear exactly where a spectator would fall. So at one point, I was very worried, would I be able to spectate at a basketball game, or would I be able to attend my daughter's graduation, because it is on school property during school hours and unfortunately at the school. So I just had a lot of worry and anxiety towards this. And it also caused a lot of worry for kids. Sometimes I would see kids in the mall and they'd be like, "Hey, Miss Sabah, we haven't seen you in a while. What's going on?" And it's hard for me to speak to them and be like, "Oh, dear."
What do you tell them?
I just tell them that, like, for now, Miss Sabah can't come in, but hopefully this changes.
That was former school volunteer Sabah Khan speaking to the CBC's Sean Henry. Last night at the Actor Awards, the crowd rose in a standing ovation when Catherine O'Hara was named Best Female Actor in a Comedy Series for her performance in The Studio. And then show co-creator Seth Rogen went up to accept the award on his late co-star's behalf and to pay tribute to her. The award comes less than a month after her death at the age of 71, which came as a terrible shock to fans who'd marveled at her phenomenal talent in roles like Moira Rose on Schitt's Creek, Kate McAllister in Home Alone, and Delia Dietz in Beetlejuice. Here is Seth Rogen speaking last night.
I obviously, you know, have been reflecting on the time I was fortunate enough to spend with her and working with her. And something that I've just been marveling at over the last few weeks was really her ability to be generous and kind and gracious while never, ever minimizing her own talents and her own ability to contribute to the work that we were doing. She knew she could destroy, and she wanted to destroy every day on set. And I haven't said this to the other actors because I didn't want them to get ideas, but pretty much every evening before she had a shooting day on our show, she would email me and Evan an email that always was pretty similar, and it said, "Hello, I hope you'll consider the following." And then there would be a completely rewritten version of the scene she was in. And literally 100% of the time, it made not just her character better, but it made the scene better and the entire show better as a whole. And she really showed that you can be a genius and be kind, and one of those things does not have to come at the expense of the other in any way, shape, or form. So I guess I'll just leave you with this. If you have people in your lives that don't know her work, if there are kids in your lives or just people who are out of touch or stupid or something, just show them O'Hara dancing to Harry Belafonte in Beetlejuice. Show them O'Hara hurting her knee in Best in Show and doing that amazing thing where she hobbles around. And tell the people as they are laughing that that's Catherine O'Hara, and we were lucky that we got to live in a world where she so generally shared her talents with us.
Seth Rogen at the Actor Awards last night, accepting an award on behalf of the late Catherine O'Hara. If you put two and two together, you will see what our friendship is for. If you can't work this equation, then I guess I'll have to show you the door. My dramatic reading of a lyric from the 1996 hit Say You'll Be There by the Spice Girls. And it might sound like a romantic rebuke, but I'm starting to think it might have been a legal warning. 22-year-old Lily Bond founded her spice business, by which I mean her food seasonings business, when she was 13. She called it Spice Girls, spice with a Y and girls with a Z. But all these years later, it seems she's going to have to change the name of her business after lawyers for the musical group Spice Girls threatened to sue. We reached Lily Bond in Ottawa.
Lily, are you or have you ever been a fan of the Spice Girls?
No, actually. I'm a 80s rock fan. So, I love Rush.
Okay. So where did this name for your business come from? When you were 13, how did this come to you?
Yeah, so when I was 13, naturally my mom was helping me a lot in the early days. Mm-hmm. So she would come with me, she would drive me to farmers markets because that's where I started selling my products, was at farmers markets. And people would always see my mom and I together and they would refer to us as the Spice Girls. And the name just kind of caught on.
Do you think, though, that they were saying that because, yes, you're women selling spices, but also there was this band out there? Did that ever cross your minds when you were, you know, spelling it out the way you did?
That was my mom and I working together, I guess, in the very early days. we were aware that, we were in completely different industries as the Spice Girls. We never thought there was going to be an issue. But naturally, just to kind of, make sure we had all of our ducks in the row. That's kind of why we spelled it that way.
Yeah, and it has been Spice Girls Seasonings, is spelt your way, has been trademarked in Canada since October 2023. So then in 2024, you get a letter, cease and desist letter. Mm-hmm. What did you think?
That was kind of a surreal experience. At that point, we were still very much a much smaller business. At that point, we were operating still mostly in Ottawa. Like, mm-hmm. our spices weren't available. Now they're available across Canada, or growing across Canada. So my first thought was, is this coming from the UK? I was thinking to myself, is the UK? Did the actual band know about us? And then I got to thinking and I realized, okay, it's probably a law firm in Ottawa that saw our products in the store and thought, okay, this is a nice bill I can send to my they're a pretty big client. Yeah.
Part of the letter reads, your brand is, quote, likely to lead the average Canadian consumer to mistakenly believe that your goods are somehow associated with our clients, unquote. What do you say to that?
Well, I did a customer survey around the time this was happening, and 100% of our customers said they never thought there was any sort of association. And a lot of the comments a lot of the messages I've been getting are people saying, we never thought you were associated, and people kind of mm-hmm. laughing at it, that who would think that a Canadian girl who sells spices is affiliated with the British UK pop band that was popular in the 90s.
And I think people would be right to think, well, they went through this process of mm-hmm. trademarking. Isn't that going to come up with any potential snags?
Exactly. The Canadian government is quite strict with that process, so they would not have approved it if the Canadian government believed it to be infringement. We had done our research fairly thoroughly as well. We had hired a trademark agency to do conduct trademark research for us to see if there was any sort of overlaps or potential for infringement or that the Canadian government was not going to approve it. And we had looked into the Spice Girls band, and we came to the conclusion that there was it was the classes of goods. There was no overlap, so that's where we were. We were safe. And to note, there is a band, sorry, there is a spice brand in the UK, or they're an ingredients spice company called Spice Girls Ingredients, mm-hmm. and spelled the same way. And they're operating, and they're trademarked, and there's no issues. So
spelled the same way as you do, or spelled the same way as the band?
As the band.
And so, with all of what you've said there, why not fight this?
Well, this was about a year of me going back and forth mm-hmm. trying to fight this on my own. I couldn't afford a lawyer because legal fees really do rack up. Mm-hmm. And all the money that I'm making, I'm putting back into inventory, sales and marketing, really just things that are helping to push the business forward and grow it. And I came to the conclusion, do I want to be taking all the profit and putting into legal fees? Or am I going to continue to grow this? Because what's really important is the product. It's the soul. It's the story. You know, the name can change, but it's the product that's what's important. And that's what I'm focusing on.
We did reach out to the law firm representing the Spice Girls to see if any members of the band might comment. We have not heard back at this point. If any of the Spice Girls see this, hear this, what would you want to say to them?
Oh, goodness. I truly don't think, at least I hope it wasn't coming from them, just with the awareness that I do have of their brand. It's about female empowerment, girl power, and I'm hoping that this was just the legal representation of Canada looking to bill, and that they truly do believe what they're promoting and what they stand for, because I don't think they would be trying to take me down. Again, I don't know. I really hope not, though.
If they did hear this, I mean, they said, you know, go ahead to their lawyers, let them be. Is it too late now for you?
I mean, I've already dropped the trademark.
Right.
And their lawyers did tell me if I was to file again that they'd oppose me it would not be good for me. So
can you tell us what the new name is going to be?
We are not releasing the new name yet. Okay. We'll be releasing that in a few weeks. We're still ironing out a few details, but I'm really excited. I think it's going to be very fitting for our brand.
You jumped into this when you were so young. What would you say to others who are listening who are thinking about doing something similar?
Go for it. Honestly, go for it. Put yourself out there. That's the biggest thing, and just be yourself and stay true to who you are through the whole process. And this has been the most incredible experience of my life. And I'm so grateful to have had this for so long. And I'm really excited for the next chapter. So why did you go after it.
Why did you want to do it in the first place? Why does a 13-year-old want to start a spice company?
Yeah, well, I was being raised by a single mom, and money was a little bit tight growing up. And I was trying to buy a computer because I was going into high school, and we just decided, you know, I can't legally get a job. So I decided, yeah, let's start a business. And I saw the gap in the market was there wasn't enough better for you, better tasting spice blends in the spice aisle. And I wanted to change that.
I appreciate this, Lily. I'm so glad we could speak. Thank you.
Me too. This has been amazing.
Lily Bond is the founder of Spice Girls. We reached her in Ottawa.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.